My name's Scott Redmond. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. I was really annoyed and irritable until about 10 minutes ago. I looked over my friend Bob Fisher, and he stuck his tongue out at me. And I love him. I love Bob F. I love him to pieces. I'll tell you why I love him. I love him because my wife loves him. And my wife loves him because early on when we came to the program 19 years ago, my wife really, really respected and held in very, very high regard Bob's wife, Ellen. And she came to know Bob through knowing Ellen. And he was one of the first, you know, drunks that my wife, Nancy, would say, geez, what a great guy. It made me feel great. It makes me feel great when a member of Alcoholics Anonymous represents us well. And I love him to pieces. And I'm sitting up here, I'm like ready to keel over. I've gone down 3 hat sizes in the last 45 minutes. And my Depends are full. And I look over and he stuck his tongue out. And I know he loves me. I love him. When I see him, that's what happens to me. If you're new, I'm sure you're thrilled for Bob and I. I'd like to welcome the guy who won the countdown. Looked like you had been voted most attractive man on your cell block. That really. Hope you never win again. Hope you never win again. And we're 2 hours into this, so I'll tell my favorite story about being bored in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new and you're bored, welcome to AA. I had a friend named Jeff D. who used to go to my old home group, the North Hollywood group, and when he was new, he was shifting around in his seat at this meeting, and his sponsor said to him, "What's the matter?" And Jeff said, "I'm bored." And his sponsor said, "Well, you know why you're bored, don't you?" And Jeff said, "No." His sponsor said, "You're bored because you're boring. That's why you're bored." And it was like an acid moment for him. He just went, wow, freaked him out. And he thought, what a cool thing to say to a newcomer. He could hardly wait till a newcomer told him that they were bored. 13 years later, no newcomer has told him that they're bored. And he was at a meeting at our old home group, and he was with this young lady who was new, and she was shifting around in her seat, and he said, "What's the matter?" And she said, "I'm bored." He said, "Well, you know why you're bored?" She said, "Yeah, because I'm with you." So if you're bored, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're a drug addict, welcome to AA. If you're a dope fiend, which is somehow worse than any of us, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're a crack monster, ooh, that's scary. Welcome there. I'd like to welcome all the tweakers. Welcome, tweakers. Yeah. Right. They have no idea why they've raised their hands. They have no short-term memory, but we're well. Glad you're here. Glad you're here. If you've ever masturbated until you're dehydrated, welcome to AA. We're glad you're here. You're so special, and we love you so much. If you've ever licked all the features off your own face, welcome to AA. But I love you guys. You stay quick for a long time. Every part of your face is moving in a different direction. You're special, special. And I'm not making fun of you. I'm coming pretty close, but but I'm not making funny. I'm really not, because I don't really care what you have. I don't care if you're the Bigfoot of dope addicts, if you're a dope Goliath, if you're the dope juggernaut. I don't care. Just catch alcoholism. Catch alcoholism. We'd love to give it to you. You know, I caught alcoholism in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. I did not have alcoholism when I got here. So if you're new and you don't have alcoholism yet, welcome. And I you know, my sponsor used to say that the infection enters through the ear, and it infects you. And that's what happened to me. But I certainly did not have alcoholism when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Number one, I'm Jewish, and Jews don't drink. Because it might dull the pain. And, you don't want to squander any agony opportunity that presents itself. But you know, it's a funny thing, that identification as a suffering Jew. We all have these identifications to these kinds of things. And once they get held up to the light, they vanish. They can't stand the light. They disappear in the light, you know. There are these things that we cling on, we get attached to, and we make them who we are until we find out this incredible thing, that we're part of this incredible thing. But my whole life, my alcoholism went below the horizon. It stopped presenting itself as a real and present danger and a real piece of business, and I drank no matter what. It's a mystery. It's an absolute mystery. There were several other reasons why I was non-alcoholic. I had been in psychotherapy for 18 years by the time I got to AA. I was going to be dead, but I was going to understand it. And I am not putting therapy down. It says on page 133 of our book, if you need a doctor, go get one. I got no beef with therapy, and I have no malpractice insurance, so I'm not apt to tell people what to do in that area. My colossal mistake with therapy, because I've used therapy many times for myself and my family in sobriety, I was trying to treat my alcoholism with psychotherapy, which is like showing up at a gunfight with a knife. It's just, and getting these colossal ass poundings, you know. I mean, the idea of most conventional therapy, Freudian-based therapy, is to uncover, discover, and unravel. To free associate, maybe you'd even delve into your past, and if you're neurotic, if you have neurosis, a neurosis is you have anxiety, and then you come up with a resolution for the anxiety, but it's worse than the anxiety. It creates more anxiety. So your solutions are worse than your problems. I don't know if this resonates for anybody here. So I'm trying to get rid of this anxiety. So I'm in therapy. I feel terrible. Why? I was so drunk yesterday. I was too drunk to walk, so I drove. Well, what are we going to do about that? Let's talk about it. Hey, I got an idea. Let's talk. What were you thinking just before you did it? Nothing. Nothing. My head got too big for my cranium. My mouth filled with saliva. The room spun. I went out for a pack of cigarettes and wound up in Baltimore. That's what happened. Treat that. Treat that with psychotherapy. So I did not have alcoholism when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a terrible journey to AA. I was brought up in the Bronx in New York City. He is definitely here with the Witness Protection Program. I know him. And there's no statute of limitations on what he's done. And I was brought up in a completely insane family. My wife never believed me about my family until she met him. And my mom threw an engagement party for us, and my Aunt Rose came to the party and wore her wig backwards. And it had a bun on it. And she wore it like beret style, sort of a jauntily askew. They're psycho. if you got anything for free in my family, it meant it was stolen. And I had an uncle who used to get, he was a welder, and he used to get free bales of steel wool. Like, here's your paycheck and your complimentary bale of steel wool. And his wife took a decorating course and made throw pillows and filled all the throw pillows with the free steel wool. So that stuff works its way through on you after a while. So when you were at their house, everybody was moving a little bit, you know. The whole room was like a living, pulsing organism. Very troubled, very, very troubled people. And there was chronic institutionalization and suicide attempts and mental and physical abuse. And if you're new here, all I've got is good news for you, because my family didn't have one single thing to do with making me an alcoholic. I'm not telling you I wasn't injured. I was terribly injured. And I'm not telling you I haven't had to do a lot of stuff about that. I have. I'm telling you they didn't make me a drunk. I have a bizarre physical reaction that makes it impossible for me to control and enjoy or moderate my drinking once I begin. I am cut out from the pack. I am a group of allergic people. This allergy does not exist in normal people. And if you're special and a drug addict, try some controlled crack smoking. You know, just fill your mouth up with crack smoke, say I'm not in the mood, and blow it out. And hats will fill the air. And you'll be so very special. And I've got this wacky thinking. It would be okay if I had this physical problem because I just wouldn't drink again, right? People who are allergic to strawberries don't find themselves all puffed up because they just can't stay off the goddamn strawberries. But I keep taking a drink because I got this wacky thinking. I've got it now. I've got it 19 years in. I had it when I walked in. I've still got it. And that's why I do more now than I have done since I came to AA. I've been hanging out with people since I got here who, when things get good, they do more. When things get bad, they do more. They do more. And I was 14 years in. I'm 14 years sober. I needed this surgery on my hand. And the doctor said to me, you know, Mr. Redmond, you're going to need general anesthetic for this. And I said, oh, general anesthetic, that's great. Normal people don't get excited about general anesthetic. There's no normal person that goes, oh, oh, oh. But I do, because I know about general anesthetic. I know that they, when they hit you with it, they say count backwards from 100. And you go, 199. I love 99. I love 99. But I won't chase 99 anymore. I won't trade my life in for 99. One of the most misquoted lines in the big book of AA for me has always been, my worst day in here is better than my best day out there. No. No. Let's see, a pound of cocaine in an all-female jazz band or a panel at Redgate. I don't know. What do you want to do? I don't know. What do you want to do? What the guy at the end of chapter 3 says is, I wouldn't trade my worst day in here for my best day out there, because I won't trade this way of life. I won't trade it in for 99 anymore. I won't do it. A couple of years after I got the surgery, I was about 16 years sober, and go to a different doctor, and he said, you know, that surgery you had on your hand, you're going to need on the other hand. And I said, guess we'll be having some of that general anesthetic. And he said, you don't need general anesthetic with this. And my first thought was, no, I need another goddamn doctor is what I need. Fast. So I got this bizarre physical reaction. I got this wacky thinking. Alcoholic thinking. It's the source of a lot of mirth at Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And I developed this cancer of the soul, this spiritual tapeworm that ate me up from the inside and left me hollow and insane and alone. I grew up in this family in the Bronx, this nutty, nutty family. And you know, if you're new here, I'm not telling you that you don't, and you come from a bad place, I'm not telling you that you don't. But I am telling you that if my problem had been my family and what was done to me, I wouldn't be talking here today. I had good therapy, you know? I would have worked out my family problems and I would have been okay if I didn't have this weird thinking and this horrible spiritual illness. And you know what? I knew what my problem was the day I walked in AAA. I didn't know it was my problem. I hated you. I hated myself. I was terrified, and I had done things sexually that I didn't recall, and most of them just involved me, and I certainly wasn't going to share them with another human being. And you know what? That only gets a round of applause at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, I'll tell you that. The Rotary doesn't, the hats don't fill the air at the Rotary. And I hated me, but nothing compared to how much I hated you. I've always hated you more than I've hated me. I'm not a suicide guy. I'm a homicide guy. I always have been. You first. And I always had this fantasy that the paper would read, Scott Redmond kills wife, kills children, and refuses to commit suicide. And I am not knocking the suicide people. I'm not putting the suicide people down. It's just the flip side of the same coin. And you before me. But I didn't know. I felt those things very intensely the first day I came in AA. The thing I didn't know was, I didn't know that was the architecture of the soul sickness that had plucked me beyond the possibility of being helped by well-meaning clergy, family, doctors, people who loved me, my hopes, my dreams, my desires, my children, anybody. You can't stack it up against that soul sickness. And I didn't want to be an alcoholic growing up in the Bronx. My father was a bartender, and he was not a drinker. He was a great guy, and But we knew a lot of people who died from alcoholism in my family, and I didn't want to be one of those guys. I overcame my alcohol problem with marijuana. I'd like to welcome all the pot smokers here today. And you remember WOW, right? Another round of applause for marijuana. It's unbelievable. You remember WOW, right? WOW.
WOW.
And right after WOW usually came, what? What? Wow. What? Wow. What? Wow. What? Wow. What? Wow. What? Watching a pot smoker is like watching a dog try to run on linoleum. There's like a lot of activity, but no movement. They just can't get a claw in the rug, man. I overcame my marijuana problem with pills. And I triumphed over pills with cocaine. Cocaine is an excellent drug. It's particularly good for sex if you enjoy sex from the Neolithic period. And kicked that gall darn cocaine with with heroin. Heroin's a very dark, complicated, artistic drug. And then you cross the line and become a vomiting pig. I gotta tell you something. I am really do not mean to offend or piss off anybody. I've been asked to tell my story. Carol asked me to talk. And so if you want to straighten anybody out after the meeting, please see Carol C. Carol T. She'd be more than happy to talk to you about it. But I really do mean that. I don't mean to offend or I'm just telling my story. And one of my ways of avoiding alcoholism was to move my way through these other addictions and other substances. And I was in my early 20s, and my father had a massive stroke, and I had just shot some heroin, and I couldn't show up for my old man the night that he died. And it was just mind-boggling to me. I just felt like a pig, like an animal. I had holes in my arms, and the curtain was down. I couldn't even go and give my pop a kiss and touch him on the cheek and watch him take his light into another room. It was horrifying to me. I just couldn't imagine how I had wound up in that place. And I had to do some quick thinking. I couldn't possibly be the guy who couldn't show up for his old man the night that he died. And I did some quick work, and I figured out it was heroin and needles, and all I had to do was never, ever put a needle in my arm again, and I wouldn't be that guy. I wouldn't be that animal who couldn't show up for his old man. Because the ice around my heart had already become so thick. I had so rearranged my life to accommodate the walk to the drink. My father wasn't moving. My father was dead and gone, and he's going to rot because this was an aimless cipher wandering nowhere. I didn't even know how much I had rearranged my life to accommodate the sickness, even by that time, and I was 21 years old. And I didn't. I didn't put a needle in my arm for 13 years. And shortly after that, I was acting in a Broadway play, and this new usherette with long brown hair walked in, and I took one look at her. I didn't even say hello to her. I walked back into the dressing room and stood on a chair in this dressing room and announced to the male members of this company that if anyone talked to the new usherette with long brown hair, that I'd break all the bones in her hands and feet. And we celebrated 28 years of marriage on June 19th. In part because we've never wanted to get divorced at the same time, which is... there's a lot of timing involved here. And a lot of love. You know, my one of the defects of character that has been so troubling to me has been mind reading. I think I know what people are thinking, and it's never done me any good at all. My wife once said to me, "You're not a mind reader. You're barely a mind user." Said it very sweetly, though. We had a great time. We were in our early 20s, living in New York. I was acting on Broadway. We had a great time. Great time. I certainly wouldn't trade my worst day in AA for that time. Nancy, after a bit of time, started becoming a little troubled and difficult. And she became kind of pronouncedly sick after a year or two. And I came home one day. We had these 32-ounce iced tea tumblers in the house. And I came home. I popped a cork on a bottle of wine and emptied the entire bottle of wine into this glass. And I turned on. My wife was giving me her pre-Al-Anon rat face. That one. And I said, "What?" And she said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I'm having a glass of wine." Can a man have a glass of wine in his own home? We got so sick that at one point a guy lent us his car and we sold his car. I will never forget this guy's voice on the phone as long as I live. He said, "You sold my car?" That's like house sitting for someone and they come back and you're in escrow, you know? The alcoholic life becomes the only normal one. We didn't have rent. No, really. And I looked into my wife's eyes and I said to her, "I am so sick of being a punk, irresponsible kid. Let's stand on our own 2 feet. Let's not borrow money. Let's do the right thing. Let's sell the car." And my wife looked at me with tears in her eyes and said, "Let's do." I was 10 years sober. I'm talking at a meeting. My wife is sitting next to her sponsor, and I tell that story, and I see her sponsor lean over to her, and her sponsor's been her sponsor since her first month, and go, "You what?" That was fun. And Nancy went, he did it. He did it. Just because I forged the pink slip, it means I did it. At any rate, I know why I was able to sell that car. It's the same reason that I get excited when I'm told I need dental surgery. I leave out the middle. I leave out the middle. I go right from you need dental surgery to Percodan. I leave out the middle. I leave out the surgery. I leave out the sutures, the incision, the whole thing. I go, "Let's do the right thing, pay the rent." I leave out Grand Theft Auto. I leave out the whole thing. So if you're new here, welcome to the middle. They're really big on the middle here. They're obsessed with it. We had our first son, Micah, and he was really, really welcomed into the world by our community. And we were surrounded by friends and family and got a ton of phone calls. And 2 years and 9 months later, when our son Jesse was born, there were no flowers, no phone calls, nobody came to the hospital. We had become completely isolated by the disease of alcoholism in just those 2 years and 9 months. And it wasn't because people didn't love us. It just hurt too much to be with us. We pressed ourselves on the people that loved us like a thumb upon a bruise. It was too hard. The ice around our heart had become so thick, it had just repelled our entire community. And Jesse got sick. He wound up in a neonatal intensive care, and I got a call from a doctor I had never met before. That night, she said, "Your wife's in extreme psychological duress. She's completely isolated here. Your son is sick. Where are you?" And I said to her, "You know, I can't find anybody to watch my two-year-old kid. I can't come down there." And this doctor, who I had never met before, said, "You know, my husband's home. I'll give you my address and phone number. You can take your son to my house, and my husband will watch him so you can be with your family." And I said, "No, I couldn't do it. I couldn't accept her generosity." And now my son, poor son Micah, had to be locked in the house with this insane man, racked with grief and shame and guilt. I would have done better to take him down to the hospital and leave him with a coloring book. And I didn't know it was alcoholism. I had no idea it was alcoholism. And then things got worse. And 2 years, actually it was so reminiscent of Bill's story where he describes this horrifying life he was leading. too scared to drink poison, dragging his mattress down from an upper floor so he won't pitch himself out of the window, waiting for his wife to come home so he can steal money for her. And then he says, "Little were we to know." And for us, little were we to know that this was going to last for 3 more years. I don't know if we could only engineer a bottom. That guy who took the book today, you know, in his first day, he might never take a drink for the rest of his life, and he might be drunk by 6 o'clock tonight. It's a mystery. It's an absolute, complete mystery. And if you're new here, I wanna congratulate you for having this opportunity. If you've actually stopped drinking, the not drinking deal is a moose. If it wasn't for the not drinking thing, we'd be a much bigger organization. I guarantee it. The not drinking thing really screws a lot of people up. But if you've stopped drinking, which means you've stopped treating your alcoholism with a drink, and you're accepting the craving, when the craving comes up, you're not treating it with a drink, you're basically saying, I will accept this craving, I'll take the whoopin'. Every craving has a beginning, a middle, and an end. An obsession doesn't. If you can accept the craving and stop treating it, you can become available for the removal of the obsession through the 12 steps, which bring about a personality change where your alcoholism will stop going below the horizon, and it will stay above the horizon as a real piece of business all the time, even when you're not concentrating on it. Because it'll be buoyed on the shoulders of the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous and the higher power that you're introduced to. It's incredible. Incredible. And as it says in our book, sometimes we come up with an appealing, compelling reason to stay sober for a period of time. But eventually, if it's of our own will and on our own juice, it will go below the horizon and it won't be palpable. It won't be real. I'll fail to recall with sufficient force the memory of the pain and humiliation of a day, a week, a second ago, and I'll begin the cycle of spree and remorse again. And instead of being, and if you're new and you're accepting that craving to drink, we have a cycle here. It's called the cycle of surrender and commitment. And it's a moose. It's got huge, huge shoulders. It's just as powerful as the cycle of spree and remorse. And what we do is we present you with some spiritual tools, not spiritual weapons, spiritual tools, so you can bridge the gap between those two cycles. It's extraordinary. On April 22nd, 1985, I crossed a line I swore I would never cross again. I put a needle in my arm. My sons were 6 and 3, and they were a wreck. My younger son couldn't stop pretending that he was a robot. My older son was reading and writing years below his grade level. He couldn't complete small tasks. His small motor skills were all screwed up. And there was nothing organically wrong with my children. They were so scared and so disrupted from being frightened all the time. They were suffering from untreated alcoholism, and I didn't know it. And this is the wreck that our life was at that time. My wife had become a tongue-chewing, babbling idiot along with me. I'll tell you what, right before I got sober, this was a good day in the Redmond home. We started on Broadway. This is where we wound up. I had an accident. They took my blood pressure. It was like 160 over 110. And the doctor said, you know, Mr. Redmond, you have high blood pressure. You're going to stroke out. We need you to lose some weight. And I said, you know, I'd like to do that. But I drink alcohol and I smoke marijuana before I go to bed every night. So I'm not going to be able to. And the doctor said, well, why don't we prescribe some medication for you? And I said, what a country. And he prescribed for me chloral hydrate. Chloral hydrate is a fast-acting knockout drop. It's a Mickey. It's like getting hit in the head with a sap. And I love these pills. I love, love, love my knockout drops. So Nancy comes home. I'm standing in the hallway eating handfuls of knockout drops and slamming my arms into the hallway walls to keep myself awake to enjoy my knockout drop. Because you don't want to waste a perfectly good knockout drop. So I keep eating pills and whacking body parts into the wall until I just seize. I keel over. And now I get into bed and now I'm incontinent like the rest of the 33-year-old men in America because I can't. I've got too much Mickey in me to get out of bed. So one night I got up and wet the wall. And my wife was excited the next morning. He wet the wall. He's headed towards the bathroom. You know, it's just progress, not perfection. And this is, it's a Wheaties morning. On April 22nd, 1985, I crossed the line. I swore I would never cross again. I put a needle in my arm again. My sons were shattered. My home life was a joke. My career had run out between my fingers like a handful of water over and over again. And I called my therapist of record in my 18th year of psychotherapy. And I told him what I had done. And he said to me that morning the exact same thing that Carl Jung told the man who 12-stepped Bill Wilson. I didn't know this at the time. But once I read our literature, it really made me feel good. Carl Jung said to this guy, Roland Hazard, after having psychoanalyzed him and Hazard drank again, Carl Jung said, I can't help you. You're beyond help. And that's what this therapist said to me. He said, there's absolutely nothing that can be done for you. And I said, what? What are you talking about? He said, I can't help you. The only thing I can suggest is is that we have you institutionalized. And this is the only thing he said that Carl Jung couldn't say. or you attend a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous. Now, why I went to the AA meeting, I couldn't tell you. I mean, I'm a guy who gets excited about dental surgery, you know. Why I didn't choose to go to the mental institution, I don't know. It's an absolute, complete mystery to me. But I set my alarm clock. I woke up at 5 o'clock in the morning. I went to a place called Unit A, which at the time was on Victory Boulevard near the lovely Tonga Hut, Polynesian-themed bar. I do believe if Satan is on Earth, he is at Polynesian-themed bars. In them big wooden heads. And I walked into this room. I took one look around this room, and I said to myself, oh, my God, how did I wind up in Alcoholics Anonymous? How lame is this? This is beyond lame. This is beyond church, beyond synagogue. This is some plateau of lameness I never even imagined was available to me. And the room looked like it was the product of like 200 years of inbreeding. I swear to God. There were identical twins carving their initials on each other's feet in the back of the room. I mean, from my point of view, right? And everything was a miracle. I'm a miracle. You're a miracle. The coffee's a miracle. And I'm waiting for the Jew hunt to break out. I know that's going to go, right? Come on, Jaime, strap these antlers on. It'll be fun. We'll knock his beanie off, and when he bends down to pick it up, we'll push him over. Always wanted to run a big buck Jew. Oh, my God. And then the AA unsolicited information guy, he saw me after the meeting, right? You know him. He's got a belt buckle large enough to serve an entire fish on. Do I want what you've got? No. No, but thanks for spitting on me, Clem. I really appreciate it. I'll come back next week. Should I bring my own bib overalls? Are we going to hook a rug? I couldn't believe it. My skin was crawling by the time I got out of there. I went back to that meeting every morning for a year. And I tell you why, I think why. I think I did, because it really is a mystery to me. There's another meeting going on over there. I was out of plans. If you're new here, I pray for you that you're out of plans. If you're new and you have a plan, it's probably a beaut. Don't use your plan. Grab one of us after the meeting. Tell us your plan. We want to know the plan. My favorite newcomer plan, and it is to this day the most utilized newcomer plan I've seen over the years, is the one more dope deal to set myself up financially for sobriety plan. It gets more popular the closer you get to Lemon Grove, I'll tell you that. But... I hated Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was out of plans. My wife, Nancy, reached out to the Al-Anon family groups, and so one of the great things about this conference is the Al-Anon participation. I'll just share this with you because I'm speaking and I can. One of the most hurtful, confusing things to me when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous is I attended a meeting now and again where I'd hear people telling jokes about Al-Anon. And I'm not talking about good-natured jokes. God knows we tell enough good-natured jokes about alcoholics. I'm talking about mean, ignorant jokes. And I would sit in my seat, and I was so proud and so happy that my wife had reached out to this thing. And I'd be very confused and injured. I'd say, geez. I mean, number one, can you imagine going to a meeting and hearing and people telling ignorant, hurtful things about Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, my heart would fall out. I mean, I know that the people would not have any functioning knowledge of the work done in AA, you know? And I'd sit in my seat and go, isn't this what we're supposed to be doing? And you know what? It is. So if you're new here, you know, I used to have all the votes. I've been whittled down to one by good sponsorship. And And until I stuck around long enough to know that the people who were doing that really didn't have a functioning knowledge of the work done in the Al-Anon family groups. But if you're doing that, yeah. If you're doing that on a public level, that's your vote that it's okay. It's my vote that it's not okay. It's my vote that it's not okay. And if you are doing that, the thing I would really urge you to do, if you're a member of AA, is maybe pick up some Al-Anon literature. Maybe read Courage to Change. Maybe listen to some Al-Anon talks. You don't have to do that, but if you're going to talk about Al-Anon, you ought to get a little information. Call me a nut, but it's the way I feel. And Nancy's Al-Anon sponsor is the love of my life, and she has been since Nancy started working with her a month in. Her name's Ruby, and her husband's name is Milton, and they've been around for a long time. And we were in really bad shape, and we had these insane rules in our house. Our kids weren't allowed to eat sugar, curse, or watch TV. So Nancy would give them a big, healthy breakfast and put them in the car with me, Dr. Death. And say, hope you live. You've had a hearty breakfast. You're going to die. But the autopsy will show a lot of whole grains. It was just insane. And Ruby would get them over. And we were just made out of wood. We were gray, you know. And Ruby would give him a big bowl of M&Ms, sit him down in front of the TV, turn on the Love Boat, and curse, you know. One day, Milton, Ruby's husband, called him. He was, I think, 15 years sober at that time. Called the boys over, and he bent down, and he whispered, boys, your parents don't know shit. And the kids went, oh, my God, we suspected, but now it's been confirmed. This is fantastic. And they have loved Ruby since they were little boys. She used to send them $5 in an envelope every birthday. She loves them to pieces. They love her. And we started making a beginning. I was about 6 months sober. I was enjoying the gift of step none. And I was doing nothing and receiving the gift of nothing. And becoming psycho. You know, when you see a guy at a meeting and he's grind his teeth down to the gums and he's got a vein pupping like a garden hose on his forehead and he's really getting the message. And I was insane. And I wanted what I saw it in my wife. And she says she saw it in me and I saw it in her. And I asked the guy to sponsor me at 6 months of sobriety. A great guy. And you know what? My favorite bumper sticker is mean people suck. And I have found that to be true in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not talking about telling the truth, but I need the scalpel of truth with the anesthetic of love. And when I came in, there were some old-timers in my area who were saying, shut up, you're a moron, sit down. And I go, oh, this sounds just like home. And the fact is it took me a while to hang around AA and listen and watch to figure in, because the deal with some of these guys was they're very wise, they've been around for a long time, they have a lot of information. They were just really mean, a bunch of these guys. And the fact is there were a lot of other old-timers who were doing inventory, working with newcomers, carrying the message and doing the thing. And I didn't want to be part of the frozen chosen, and I stayed away from those guys and have stayed away from them for 19 years. Those guys have not been my sponsors, you know. And I got this guy to sponsor me, and he invited me over to his house. He made sure I'd done some reading from the big book of AA, and he took me through chapter 5 and took me through the first two steps. We got to step 3, got on our knees and said a prayer, which I felt was embarrassing and unnecessary, but I did it anyway. And then he took me back and he gave me instructions on how to do a fourth step in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I stopped feeling like I was stealing someone's seat here. 3 months later, I went back and I read him my fifth step. And at 9 months of sobriety, I did 6 and 7 for the first time, and I wrote up my eighth step list. And I try to share this anytime I talk because it's simply the best reading of Step 8 I've ever heard. And I heard it from a guy in my home group. And I saw this when I was about, I saw this guy do this when I was about 2 months sober, and I've never seen him again. He was a guy named Nino. He had a heavy New York accent, and he had never read Chapter 5 before. And he was there with a hospital group. He had hospital plastic on, and he was reading Chapter 5 in front of this men's group for the first time. And he got up to Step 8, and he read,
made a list of all those we had harmed, and became willing to make amends to them all. Jesus Christ! And he looked out into the room as if to say, have you seen this? Do you know what the hell is in here? And it was so beautiful. First of all, it's the only thing I saw on the list. I didn't see anything else on the list, you know. Not those people, not that money. I wouldn't have taken that much money if I knew I had to give it back. You think I'm an idiot? If you're new, don't worry about it. It's 8 steps from where you are anyway, for God's sake. And 8's not even the annoying one. It's 9. Really, really annoying. So I wrote up my 8th step, and I didn't know what I was going to do about it. I didn't know what I was going to do about my dad or my kids or my wife. I just didn't know. I could not sit down with my sons and apologize to them. They were little boys, and it would have been a horrible burden to place upon them. Well, I was going to sit down with my wife and say, hey, hon, sorry about this 8-year suicide pact we've had. I couldn't. And I was blessed with a sponsor who wouldn't tell me how to make amends. He said, do your job in AA. Do your job, man. Address your inventory as your spiritual task. Do your job in Alcoholics Anonymous. And thank God I got that. Anytime a guy I sponsor tells me that they are working on themselves, I always want to go, step away from yourself. Step away from yourself, sir. It's terrible. It's terrible. It's one drunk talking to himself. And my disease reacts terribly to a frontal assault. So if you're new, this moral psychology, this self-examination with a moral application is engineered so that I can take action seemingly disconnected and unrelated to what I really think my problem is. And I'm changing a way of life, a way of thinking, a way of believing, a way of comporting myself. All of it shakes down to the central stuff. All of it will be taken care of, they told me. And I didn't believe him, but I was out of plans. I was out of plans. And faith, you know, I used to think faith was belief, but I know it's not today. Belief is belief. I like my beliefs because I believe in them. They feel good to me because I believe in my beliefs. But faith to me is the perfect expression of step 2. It's actually exposing myself to the truth despite the consequences. That essence of step 2 where I've said, I'm going to move forward on this. I am. I think it's possible. I think there's a possibility here, and I'm going to act on that possibility, you know. And that has kept me in good stead in Alcoholics Anonymous for 19 years. And I still, my sponsor and my spiritual advisor still make suggestions to me that I think are ill-advised, the product of a lot of brain damage and difficulty, and I continue to do that. And I had to do some stuff that was really unpleasant with my kids. I had to go into their school and advocate for them. I had my children had terrible problems, and I had to go into the school and sit down with these teachers and say, you know, my children have been very ill because they've been living with me. I've been very sick, and we're making a beginning. Can you help us? And not once has anyone said no, not one time. They said, sure, let's test the boy. The boys got tested, and they needed help. They went to special ed. Special ed classes had fantastic suggestions, you know. And they said, get him into sports. Get him into music. Maybe the big motor stuff will shake down to the little motor stuff. And so I spent some dope dollars on buying my kid a mitt, you know, a few booze bucks on registering him in the Little League. We had become so uncivilized. This stuff just wasn't part of our lexicon. It wasn't part of our deal. And Jesse wanted to play drums, so I didn't have any dough. So I went and bought him a drum pad, which is a piece of wood with a piece of rubber and 2 sticks. And I went to my home group, and I told the guys what I had done. And if you got a home group like I had, you'll know why I told them, because they wanted to know. Because they were interested in my family. Because they were rooting for us. Because they loved me. And within 2-3 months, the AA drum set showed up at our house. There were like a lot of burnout drummers in my group at that particular time. So guys are showing up with these Megadeth drums, you know. dude. And Jesse had a drum set so big, when he sat behind it, he disappeared. Couldn't even see him. And a couple of years ago, my sons played the House of Blues on the Sunset Strip, both of them. Just burnt the dump down. 800-900 kids playing hip-hop music to this packed room, and there's this group of weeping middle-aged alcoholics standing over on the side, you know. Kids are kind of going, what is with the crying old people, man? What is... Usually they bring backup singers. I was about a year sober, and I was starting to kind of become a spiritual Goliath at this particular time, and I was starting to sponsor guys, and I got an overture made to me near that end of that first year to direct a situation comedy, to be a staff director on a sitcom. I did one episode, and I thought that if I got the staff directing job, I was up for this job, that it would really, really benefit the men I sponsor, because they'd really see the program work. As they saw me prosper. And I didn't get the job, and I almost drank. And I went cuckoo. And my sponsor said, I guess you have the show business God. And I said, what? He said, well, what keeps you sober? I said, God keeps me sober. He said, okay, God keeps you sober. You didn't get a show business job, and you almost drank. So I guess you have the show business God, and he has abandoned you utterly. Now, when I came in Alcoholics Anonymous, I had heard God getting people into relationships, God getting people jobs, God getting people parking spaces. Oh, no, not the parking space, God. Not the parking space, God. What if you don't get a space? And if you have a parking space, God, and he gives you a space, pass it on. A couple of years ago, we got nailed in the Northridge earthquake. We got really beat up real good. Our house got wrecked up, and I got a physical injury, and it was really bad. And shortly after the quake, we were at a function out of town, an AA function, and a woman who used to live in L.A. walked up to me at this function and said to me, oh, I'm so glad God got us out of L.A. before the quake. And I said, oh, he likes you. He likes you, but we're crap. But he likes you. And she said to me, I guess he just felt you had some lessons to learn. Thank you for mouthing that word. That was right. I'm out of here. I can't live in a world with a God like that. I can't possibly want to stay sober and live in a world with a God that's going, get him. Get the Redmond boy. Get him. Get him. No evacuation plan for you, Jew boy. Get him. Get him. Smote him. Smote his ass. Smote anyone he talks to. I can't live in that world. I cannot live in that world. I got a guy I used to sponsor who, just a great guy. He was a crackhead, lived on the, you gave me a napkin. Now I think there's crap all over my face. Is there crap all over my face? Okay. they're moving in on me now. And our home group loved this guy. He came in. He was sleeping on his crack dealer's floor. And he was like 10 or 11 months sober. And I'm driving him to the meeting. And he said, look, I met a girl 6 weeks ago. She's pregnant. We want to have the baby. I want to get married. What do you think? And I took a breath. And because I'm pretty feel okay and I'm not blocked by a lot of resentment at this point, I'm kind of smoking along. I said, I'll do whatever you want. What do you mean? If you don't want to have the baby, I'll back you up. If you want to have the baby and get married, I'll be your best man. Because I have the sponsorship I came from, there were no hard and fast rules. You took it on a case-by-case basis. And that's what I did. I didn't play God with the guy. So, at any rate, the group was really into it and excited about this, you know. And the baby was born, and the baby was terribly ill. The baby had 1 foot in death's door. She was rushed to the hospital. She was placed on an ECMO machine, which connects a machine to the heart. The blood had to be taken out, oxygenated, and put back in the baby. I mean, it's just one of the most invasive, miserable things that can happen. You know, and we went back to the home group, and the guys found out, and they threw $900 in a basket, because this guy is a working guy. He needs to be with his family now, and he needs to not work. And I've seen this happen, and you've heard about it this week, and I've seen this in AA over and over and over again. Now, to go to neonatal intensive care, you got to be a relative. So now all the baby's relatives are showing up. 6'6" Ethiopian men. Overweight Jews, Asian women. And the nurses, after all, went, "Don't pause to lie, just go." You know. Then the call for blood went out. So 2 weeks after the baby was home and okay, they called this guy and go, "Look, they're dropping blood off in jars, you know." I mean, first of all, most of us can't give blood because we're X-hypes or we got fresh ink, right? So, but we'll go just to get pissed off, and why won't you take my blood? You know, and the fact is that marriage didn't survive, but that baby did. And those two people are doing a magnificent, magnificent job of raising this gorgeous little kid. And you know what? I don't know if I could have, but I might have just decided to play God and crush that entire thing. And this whole demonstration of love and commitment would have had to go somewhere else, you know. But there was a baby in that ward named Rachel Wang. I hope I never forget her. And she sat right next to the baby who we were there with. And Rachel Wang came in, and Rachel Wang passed away. I can't live in a world with a God that's a baby annihilator. My God expects me to do my job in AA, whether it's to show a guy how to stay sober through the annihilation of a child or the survival of a child. I don't have a God taking children. And I've seen my friends and the people I love and look up to in AA, I've seen them do it all. I've seen them do it all. I can live in that world. My God expects me to do my job in AA if it's to show a guy how to live in a house on a hill or in a refrigerator box. I don't have a God saying, "Let's key your car. It's boils for you. You're due for a rash." And I want to tell you something. I believe in the big book of AA. I believe St. Thomas. I believe the mystics, that God is absolute and complete mystery, that to know God is to not know God, that no one can fully comprehend or define that power which is God. So every time I say it's God's will that I take this job or that job, I make a tiny... Every time I ascribe a personality to God, for me, I just cut the ring on myself like a bad boxer, you know? So... it's been a great relief to me. And I want to tell you, it's also hard to deal with the mystery sometimes. It's difficult for a lot of people, and it's difficult for me. At any rate, I had to write this resentment against this company for not hiring me for that job, and for myself for almost drinking. And my sponsor said, "You know, when you do 6 and 7 this time, man, you are going to have some serious conversation with your higher power." And I did 6 and 7 that day. And I said, "You know what, Pop? You got it. Take show business. I'm done. I'm done with the show business, God. You can take show business. I will do anything you want for a living. I'll do anything for a living. Anything. Just keep me sober." And within 3 months, I was working as a cook on a catering truck. And I looked up and I said, "I did not mean this. I did not. This wasn't even on the long list. We've had a grotesque misunderstanding." Now, in L.A., when they make a TV show or a movie, they hire a caterer. You follow them around. You make food for them, and you make great dough. It's Teamster dough. You're on a vehicle on a movie set. It's great dough. But I'm Scott Redman. And the first movie that I cater, the executive producer and star of the movie, is a guy who I've worked with in the business. And he stuck his head on the truck that morning and he said, "Can I have a burrito?" "Scott?" And I said, "What's happening, babe?" And he said, "Is this your truck?" I said, "No, but it's my spatula." I went home, I called my sponsor, and I said,
Oh, we're getting the gift now. Oh, it's beautiful. It's beautiful sobriety. And he said to me, sounds like you've got a resentment. Now, I don't just hate things. I re-experience the hatred, and I hate them in a way that when I wake up, I water my hatred like a little flower and I care for it. I want to make sure that it's developing properly and that it's safe. The worst thing is when I forget to hate something, and the guy goes, hi, and I go, hi, oh, I hate him, why did I do that? If I had just had a moment to think that I need to snub him, now I'm going to have to redouble my snubbing and glaring just to remind him that I hate him. I hate so that when my head hits the pillow, it becomes a rotisserie. It eats my brain and my heart and turns my life black. There's no room for me in my own life. Resentment's no big deal. It's just the source of all spiritual illness, the great destroyer of all alcoholics. It'll cut you off from the sunlight of the spirit, drag your ass out, and kill you dead, but don't worry about it. Work a step a year. Not a big deal. I'm going to die. So what is it in me that if God were to remove blue skies, God's got a magic wand, he comes and touches me on the head. What is it in me that if God were to remove the resentment would be God? I'm resentful at Scott for working on a kitchen truck. It affects my self-esteem, pocketbook, ambition, personal relations, and sex. A five-bagger for sure. What is it in me? I'm impatient. I'm greedy. I'm ashamed. I'm not living in today. I'm not trusting in God. I'm ungrateful. Terrible list. And this is what I had to take to my higher power to read to my sponsor, and he gently and lovingly made a few additions to my list, which I seem to have left off. And I cooked, man, and every week I wound up coming back to my home group with another tale of humiliation. I wound up feeding people I had directed in shows, people who had been my assistant stage managers and assistant directors, and I'd come back and tell the guys, and they'd just go, ho, ho, ho. And I cooked for like 3 years. And you know what? My son, Jesse, when he was a little boy, asked me to teach him how to cook. He wasn't interested in me as a writer and director. He and I have been cooking together. He's 23. And we still go to the market together and pick out what's fresh and make food together. And that's not how I would have chosen to be intimate with my son, you know. And I started to be able to help some people who had felt they had fallen from a height when they came to AA. They hadn't achieved the top rank in AA, which is Child of God. I had a friend named Paul who felt he had fallen from a height, and he used to say this prayer. He says, God, I'm so grateful. Thank you so much. Please keep me sober. I'll do anything you want for a living, but don't let it be as bad as what you did to Scott. Please. I was so glad to help him out. And I had been doing this for a while, and I had an overture made to me by a big public relations firm in New York called Ketchum Public Relations. And this was for a big time comedy writing job. And, you know, I really felt very strongly that if I got this job with Ketchum, it would really benefit the guys I sponsor in a very unique way, because they had seen me suffer, but now they'll see the program really at work. And I went cuckoo before I even found out about the job. My brain blew up. I went mad. And I had to write about it. I did a videotape for these guys. And I had to write about it. I read it to my sponsor. I prayed about it. And a couple of weeks after that, I get the call from Ketchum that I did not get the job. And I was cool with it. And shortly after that, I get a call from my catering company to go up to Arrowhead up in the mountains and cater some commercials up there. So I got in the truck, got up there. And I grabbed the call sheet, which gives you all the information about the deal, and I saw that the commercial was for Ketchum Public Relations. I'm feeding them now. Now I'm feeding them. I looked down at the end of the truck. There's a guy videotaping me. I said, what are you doing? He said, oh, we're taping the making of the commercial. He's taping my humiliation. He's going to go back to New York. He's going to show the guys in New York. And they're going to go, is that Scott Redmond with the meatloaf? That poor son of a bitch.
I go home and I call my sponsor and I said, oh, we're getting the gift now. Oh, it's a miracle. It's just a miracle. This beautiful miracle. And my sponsor said to me, I guess God had enough writers and needed a few cooks today. And then he said, you know, Scott, you told God you wanted to work for Ketchum and you forgot to tell him what you wanted to do. You told Nancy and I not to get involved in our first year, and we didn't. We stayed the hell away from each other. We were really sick and really having a lot of difficulties. I didn't have anything to bring to my marriage, anything to bring to my wife or my life. I couldn't fight. I didn't know how to fight. I would scream until she shut up, or I would cry until she shut up. Either one's fine with me. I've always loved the tyranny of helplessness. I'm also a loomer. I like to loom. I'm big. I like to get a light behind me and get her in the shadow. I like to get her in the shadow. It's like Total Eclipse of the Jew, if I can get her like right in there, right? And if I can like work a scream, a loom, and a cry into one fight, that's a hat trick. It doesn't get any better than that. So these are the tools that I'm bringing. This is what I'm bringing. I'll give you the Scott Redmond couples workshop right now. 11 seconds. You ready? Here we go. Talk to her until she changes her mind. Talk to her until her eyes roll back in her head and she keels over. And on the way over, she goes, oh, okay. That's it. That's what I'm bringing to the deal. And I'm a slob. I don't clean up after myself. I don't feel like a grown man. I have never felt like a grown man until I came into AA and did the work. Grown men make their bed. But I don't know that. Somewhere in the back of my twisted mind, I think that a certain amount of housework should equal a certain amount of sex. That there should be like conversion tables on the back of cleaning products of housework to sex. I'm bringing nothing. Nothing. And we got sicker and sicker, and we hung in there and hung in there. And my sponsor, Paul, used to say to me, he would suggest that we pray together. Ooh. Ooh. Now, I'll pray with a puppy-strangling felon who's been out of prison for a minute and a half in a public place, right? Have you taken the third step? We're in the Greyhound station, right? No, I haven't. Get on your knees. We're men of God. But pray with my wife, my lover, my buddy, my bride, with my companion seemed unnecessary and embarrassing to me. And we went to therapy, we developed some great tools together, and then we came home and threw a Buick at each other because, and I didn't know it at the time, we didn't have a moral application for the self-examination we were going through. And until we finally, in desperation, started holding hands and just not taking the steps together, our prayers were, Pop, can you please help me to stop taking everything personally? Good morning. What do you mean? Can you stop? Help me stop taking everything personally. Can you help me to have a sense of humor? Can you help me to remember that I love my wife? And now we do, sometimes we'll say, you're forgetting that you love me. Which is very helpful. My wife in her Al-Anon family, and I'm sure it happens in a lot of families and cultures in the program, were encouraged to, when things spin out, I don't know if in our house, in the car, they start to spin out when my wife starts stepping on the imaginary brake on her side of the car. I seem to get a little psycho. I don't know what it is. And things started moving pretty quick. And she would say, you know, honey, you could be right. And one day we're going, and we were pretty new, and it starts moving really fast. And Nancy said to me, you know, sweetheart, you could be right, but not today. Not today. It's not your day, big guy. I'll let you know. Now I'm scared that if I wipe my face, it's going to, like, turn black or something. If you're new, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. The bad news is, I'll give you the good news first. The good news is our problem mainly rests in our mind.
If our problem didn't mainly rest in our mind, we wouldn't be here today. We wouldn't be doing this gorgeous demonstration of the power of God in our lives. My sponsor used to say that Alcoholics Anonymous was the only recovery from a fatal illness that left the sufferer in better condition than they were in before they contracted the disease. Wow. What a gorgeous, gorgeous thing that is. My alcoholism has stayed above the horizon as a real piece of business. You know, they say that our disease is out there doing push-ups. I accept that, but turnaround is fair play. So is my recovery. Because even when I'm not focusing on it, I don't drink. And that's a miracle. That is an absolute miracle, even when I'm not concentrating on it. Because I believe that the basic idea of God does exist in all of us. I believe there's a connective tissue. I believe that there is a desire to love and be loved. I believe everyone's got it. I believe Nazis have it. Nazis love other Nazis. And our book says it, even though it can be befogged by many, many different things. And if you're new here, I want to urge you to blow on the ember of that connective tissue, to find a way to become part of, to find the fellowship that you crave and that's going to be absolutely perfect for you. And the bad news is our problem mainly rests in our mind. Some years ago, I was at a meeting, I met a new guy, and I went home, he called me, and he talked to me for an hour. I said, four times, so he'd know I wasn't dead. And he explained to me he had been stalking several women, and they had restraining orders out against him, but he's 2 weeks sober, it's all different now. And at the end of the hour, he said to me, I feel so alone. I said, what are you talking about? I don't even know you. I just listened to you for an hour without interrupting you. And he said, well, I mean, I don't have a woman. And I said to him, what exactly would you be bringing to a relationship right now besides stalking skills? What are you bringing to the party? People 2 weeks into remission from leukemia aren't having dating problems. Alcoholics are, because our problem mainly rests in our mind. A couple of years ago, my wife was walking through our bedroom, and she knew I was talking to a new guy. And she heard me saying to the phone, let's say the aliens are coming. And she stopped short. She ain't missing a second of this. I said, look, man, I'm not telling you the aliens aren't coming. That's an outside interest. They might very well be coming. But I have a question for you. Why you? Why have they come for you? Why have they traversed a galaxy for your sorry ass? You're 11 days sober. You have no life. Why you? Don't you think they'll look, call a cop, go to a post office, something? Plus, he's sleeping with a Bible on his chest to ward them off. So they're going to traverse the universe, walk in his room, go, oh, no, the Bible. Let's go home. I'm sharing this at my home group right after it happened. And the guy who I had the conversation with walks in while I'm telling the story. I'm watching the cat. I'm telling the story. And the guy goes like this. He goes, Oh, shit. If you're new here, I want to urge you as much as I possibly can to take this thing as seriously as you possibly can and go out there and have the time of your life. If the aliens are coming for you, welcome to AA. Welcome home. Thanks so much for having me today.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the Month Club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.